Good morning. This is the International Connection, and as every Saturday it comes to you with Tom Rich and Bob Marshall, it again comes to you with Tom Rich, Bob Marshall, and myself, Adam Vaughn. Today's topic of discussion is Dr. Peter Beter's explanation surrounding the events about a possible nuclear strike. It's audio letter 79. Bob, perhaps you can introduce the subject and we'll get right to the tape.
Yes, yesterday I read the summary of the Dr. Beter tape recorded at the end of August 1982, where he explained what would happen to lead up to the terrible events of September 17, 1982. He said the plans were afoot to have this happen, this nuclear first strike initiated by the Bolsheviks in the Pentagon. It did not happen, but Dr. Beter will explain that in the tape that we are now going to feature.
Okay, now this is an interesting exercise in some respects. One, it's a prediction that doesn't come true, and two, it's a rationalization of why that prediction didn't come true. So we're going to take a listen to the tape and remind you that the International Connection looks at this stuff as an interesting topic of discussion and to take it as such, and listen for the conversation following and interspersed with parts of the tape to fully appreciate why the show is doing what it's doing.
My three special topics for this audio letter are topic number one, the aborted plan for surprise nuclear war. Topic number two, the Beirut massacre for war to come. And topic number three, the return of the Siberia Express weather war. Topic number one, when I recorded audio letter 78 late last month, I made public the final Pentagon plans for nuclear war one to erupt this month, September 1982. The Pentagon war planners were counting down toward Friday, September 17, to set off nuclear war as a complete surprise. But as the final days ticked away this month, major snags began to develop in the rush war timetable. Finally, the decision was made to scrub the planned nuclear first strike against Russia virtually at the last minute. As I reported last month, the first H-bombs were to be detonated on key Russian targets at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on September 17. The order to scrub the attack went out less than 5 hours before that, shortly after 10 a.m. that morning. When a decision finally came to abort the attack, it was a judgment call. And that judgment was far from popular with some members of the elite Bolshevik war planning team in the Pentagon. The snags which developed this month were very serious, but not serious enough to completely rule out an attempted nuclear strike. As a result, the war planning group became splintered into acrimonious debate over what to do. No one argued in favor of giving up the basic goal of attacking Russia, but there was a sharp division over how best to save the nuclear war plan. Basically, the argument boiled down to two alternatives: whether to postpone the nuclear strike or whether to go ahead as planned. The hotheads insisted that the surprise nuclear attack against Russia should proceed on schedule on September 17. They argued that in spite of the problems which had cropped up, delay would only give time for even more obstacles to develop. They also pointed out that their intelligence on Russian targets will gradually grow stale with delay. In effect, they said, now is our best chance. The more conservative faction among the war planners insisted that the hotheads were not thinking straight. In their view, the hitches which developed this month in the war plan were too serious to go ahead now. Better to wait and reschedule the Project Z war plan after removing the present obstacles to success. The debate began to tip in favor of a postponement 1 week before the September 17 target date. For that reason, other contingency plans were set in motion in the Middle East during that final week. But the nuclear strike plan remained in effect right down to the wire. In the end, it was an accumulation of many factors which finally caused the plan to be aborted. The Bolsheviks here started running into trouble in their rush nuclear war plan almost as soon as it started, early this year, 1982. I first reported that a shortcut nuclear war strategy was being implemented by the Pentagon 7 months ago in audio letter 72. At the same time, I also reported that the Rockefeller cartel and the Russians were lining up to try to stop the war plan. To that end, they had agreed to start working together against the American Bolsheviks in certain ways. On top of that, a coup d'etat was brewing here in Washington to be led by General Alexander Haig, then Secretary of State. In the 7 months since I recorded audio letter 72, world headlines repeatedly have been filled with the consequences of this three-way struggle. First came the Falklands War last April, which was not about sheep and settlers, but about secret weapons installations. The secret Pentagon war plan received a severe blow in that skirmish, but the Bolsheviks here soon struck back. In June, they destroyed the Haig coup d'etat. At the same time, the brutal Israeli invasion of Lebanon was underway, right on the timetable which I had made public last year, and which Sharon, defense minister of Israel, confirmed only this week in the Knesset. And then there was the fourth space shuttle, which carried the Defense Department payload into orbit to prepare for war. By midsummer, leaders of both America and Russia were making statements that the superpowers were already at war. The Russians started firing warning shots across America's bow by way of weather modification, airplane disasters, and more. Finally, last month, on August 12, the Russians used sheer intimidation to thwart the Israeli plan for an incredibly bloody invasion of Beirut. Suddenly, the PLO evacuation talks bore fruit, and the evacuation went off without a hitch. It was a serious blow to the joint Bolshevik-Zionist efforts to create an atmosphere of mushrooming crisis as a prelude to nuclear war. For about 2 weeks, the atmosphere of world crisis appeared to almost evaporate. But the Pentagon war clock was still counting down towards September 17, and the Russians knew it.
Okay, let's deal with a few of these allegations and a few of these remarks. One that concerns me, and I think it'll concern a number of listeners as well, is the sudden introduction of a Zionist-Bolshevik alliance. This is a very tender topic insofar as it implicates a lot more people than I think Dr. Beter intends it to, and I think you're familiar with that.
Well, once again, these labels are very difficult to deal with. As Mallarmé said, to define is to kill, and to suggest is to create. And I think we have to look at Dr. Beter in terms of him suggesting groups, and I think it's difficult to give a definition to it because, unfortunately, it tends to leave a lot of people who are behind these movements get away scot-free from being identified.
Yeah, but I think the other thing that has to be remarked upon is the fact that when he says Zionist-Bolshevik alliance, he's not implicating all Zionists, and for that matter, all Bolsheviks. He's identifying those members of organizations that he feel represent those situations. It's a very dangerous statement. It's almost borders on racism.
That's right. Now, what he means by Bolsheviks, he talks specifically about the Khazar element, which is a particular group of people came out of the area around the Caucasus Mountains and that part of Russia. Now, the Khazars, he says, have control banking through the Rothschild interests. He says the Rothschild interests, so it's not just the Rothschild, it's people associated with the Rothschilds in their business dealings, and they were a power elite that came through 200, 300 years ago.
So it isn't the Zionist movement, it's an economic unit within the Zionist movement that doesn't necessarily speak for the Zionist movement.
Yeah, originally the Khazar Bolsheviks wanted to get back Russia from the Christian faction, the Christian Tsar. So they set up the communist revolution in Russia.
Okay, I think we'll investigate that a little bit later. But the other point is here is I see this as the weakness of all conspiracy thinkers. And I think Dr. Beter, of all the sources we use, is the most suited to that term, conspiracy thinker. What happens here is he makes a prediction that doesn't materialize, and he uses a barrage of world events surrounding it to rationalize why it didn't happen. And there's a weakness, because essentially he's defeating his own argument, which only he can defeat because only he constructed and has evidence for.
Well, I'd like to point out several things that did happen leading up to the September strike, is that he was had a sense of urgency the first of 1982, and then the Falklands War came. And then he talks about the resignation of Haig, if Haig does not succeed in his coup. And he said it would happen to happen have to happen by June 27th, and Haig resigned June 25th. So there was a prediction that occurred. And also, he said the Bolsheviks established a coup in June around the world to consolidate their forces to stave off Haig's move. And you have the famous death of Roberto Calvi and a lot of the Rockefeller-associated people that May and Skolnick and LaRouche have documented, the scandal that came out of the collapse of the Bank Ambrosiano. That happened in June. So an incredible number of events that were reported in the media that happened in June. It's just that Beter was working from a loftier view.
Okay, so essentially what you're trying to do is you're tying in together a number of world events that actually did happen.
Yes.
It still has a sort of a rationalizing after the point taste to it, and it's hard to swallow in that respect.
Yeah, but he did predict Haig or Reagan resigning by June 27th,
yeah.
And that happened on June 25th.
Okay. Well, why don't we take a listen to the rest of the tape, and we'll get back to discussing it.
The Pentagon war clock was still counting down towards September 17, and the Russians knew it. On September 2, the Soviet Union abruptly disconnected all direct dial telephone service to and from the West. Instead, military operators took over. It was an extension of the telephone cutbacks, which had begun months earlier. To the top Pentagon war strategists, the Russian telephone service cutback of September 2 seemed like small potatoes. They had bigger things to worry about, namely a serious turn of events in Red China. The previous day, September 1, Communist Party Chairman Hu Yaobang had dropped a bombshell at the Party Congress in Peking. He declared that China should no longer ally itself with the United States against Russia. Instead, Hu said China should regard both superpowers as equal threats. But at the same time, he included some conciliatory language toward Russia. And, my friends, high Russian officials will go to China to begin talks in 2 weeks' time at China's invitation. By disowning the Sino-American alliance, Hu Yaobang made it clear that the secret American stealth attack base in China was in jeopardy. That base, located in Red China's western Xinjiang province, is essential for the intended attack on Russia's two cosmosphere bases in Siberia. Last month, I reported that this war base was the reason for the joint communique of August 17 by the United States and Red China concerning Taiwan. The communique commits the United States to discontinue arms deliveries to Taiwan at some future date in violation of Reagan's past pledges. The communique was agreed to in order to head off a threatened shutdown of the stealth base by the Chinese, but it was not enough to satisfy the Chinese. On September 6, former President Richard Nixon arrived in Peking, adding further to the troubles of the Pentagon war planners. Nixon has long been a client follower of the Rockefeller cartel, as I detailed in my book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, nearly 10 years ago. Nixon went to Peking this month as a Rockefeller envoy, and one with far more credibility for the Chinese than anyone the Bolsheviks have. Nixon shocked the Chinese by confirming what Russian sources had already told them, that the stealth base was about to be used in war. Nixon then counseled them not to shut down the base outright at this time, for fear of undesirable reactions by the trigger-happy Pentagon Bolsheviks. Instead, he urged the Chinese to start interfering with operation of the stealth base by bureaucratic devices. That is one thing the Chinese are very good at, and they accepted Nixon's advice. By September 9, the American stealth base in Xinjiang Province, China, was effectively out of action. Critical base personnel were tangled up in Chinese red tape, preventing them from reporting for duty. The Chinese are giving hints to Washington that all this is due to continued dissatisfaction over Taiwan. But the real reason, my friends, is that they want no part of nuclear war with Russia. The Kremlin received word through Rockefeller channels on September 9 that the Xinjiang province stealth base had been effectively neutralized. At that point, the Russians could rest assured that even if the Pentagon went through with its nuclear attack plan, Russia's cosmospheres would survive. Russia's critical space triad of strategic weapons could no longer be destroyed. The time had come to carry out the most dangerous step in the Kremlin plan to unravel the Pentagon nuclear war plan. The time had come to destroy the attack confirmation sensor placed in space by the space shuttle last June. The attack confirmation sensor was a special sensor.
One thing I wanted to point out here is Dr. Beter just talked about Russia's Triad network. And I thought it would be interesting just to point out that basically what he means here by the Russia's Triad network is basically made up of one of the segments of that triad are what he calls cosmospheres, which are floating platforms approximately 300 miles above the Earth's surface, in which there are particle beam weapons. A piece that I wanted to bring in for quite a while that I found about this is from a chap by the name of Bruce Sibley, who works and is the full-time technical writer with the Civil Defense Institute. And it's interesting to note, when we talk about this, Dr. Beter as being far out, it's interesting to note that quite a while ago, Sibley wrote the following under the term exotic weapons, the death ray. He says that at some time during 1976, shortwave listeners in North America began to intercept a considerable amount of radio interference, which started at 5 megahertz and ended at 30 megahertz. This was not the ordinary rushing sounds or hissing, crackling noises, nor the rasp of Russian jamming stations. This was a rapid tut-tut-tut-tut sound, one that erupted suddenly in the middle of a clear band and then gradually changed frequency, sliding up or down the entire frequency spectrum. What was it? Well, the author believes that the explanation for these Soviet radio transmissions is that the Soviets had perfected a proton gun along the lines which he earlier discusses with regard to energy interacting with lasers and the like. Basically, a particle beam is what he's saying. So I just thought that it'd be make the point here that there are outside writers, if it's not too difficult to find, technical writers who are involved in the military establishment who have noted actual evidence of what Beter's saying exists.
Okay, there's a couple other points that perhaps can be discussed at this point. His discussion of the Chinese, again, there's some tones in there which are very confusing, and there seems to be an element of Beter which is almost it's almost bigoted, and it seems to be he uses Zionists in the same way as he just used the Chinese, saying that their bureaucratic mishandling is typical and they're very good at it, and very sarcastic referral to the Chinese people as a nation. And I'm wondering how much of that colors his judgment and colors his ability to objectively verify the facts that he uncovers.
No, he didn't. He was explaining that the Chinese used that fact, the general myth about the Chinese, of their red tape and bureaucratic setup, to give an excuse to the Americans why they weren't going to cooperate in the Sinkiang Tiang province bases.
So they ran interference on purpose.
Yeah, they decided to back off after Nixon spoke to them.
Okay, now essentially what he's, to sort of paraphrase quickly and to get back to the tape, he's essentially said that there are a number of incidences that were created to ward off a nuclear attack, and he mentioned the Lebanon incident. He mentioned several sort of coincidental elements. And what he said about China is that Nixon went there to disrupt deployment methods, to encourage the Chinese to back away from Pentagon war planning.
Right. They had heard from the Russians that the Pentagon was doing this, but they didn't have any confirmation from the United States. So since the Rockefeller cartel had temporarily was working with the Russians, they sent Nixon over, a client of the Rockefeller cartel, to confirm what the Russians were telling Chinese.
Okay, so essentially what you have here is the Rockefeller faction within the United States getting in the way of the Pentagon.
That's right, the Pentagon Bolsheviks.
Okay. We'll get back to the tape in just a couple of seconds, but I'm wondering, what's the tape about to lead us into, just so we can get our minds back onto?
The Russians now had to knock off the attack confirmation sensor that was orbiting over the Indian Ocean. The Bolsheviks needed that satellite to see where their missiles landed. And so the Russians now are making the risk, taking the risk to knock that out. They're risking that the Bolsheviks could get really panic and respond to that.
So what's happened is that crisis has been developed to prevent a war, and now the Russians are taking military action to prevent that war.
Yeah, and one signal of that was the phones being cut off, and I remember that in 1982.
Okay, we'll take a listen to the tape and get back to discussion.
Light placed in geostationary orbit over the Indian Ocean by an auxiliary rocket. As I've reported before, it was a cryogenic satellite. That is, it was maintained at super cold temperatures, close to absolute zero. I can now reveal that this was intended to protect the satellite from detection by Russian space weapons. For several years now, American scientific intelligence analysts have known that the Russians have a new technology for target acquisition. The new Russian technique is not radar, nor is it any other conventional means of detecting and tracking targets. The new Russian technique is deadly accurate, reliable, and unlike radar, impossible to jam. Analysts here some time ago convinced themselves that they had figured out what the new Russian technique is. They believe it is a Russian version of computer-enhanced infrared detection. This has now been developed here in the United States and is called SEER, C-E-I-R. I first reported on this development in Audio Letter 72, shortly after a SEER-equipped American laser was used to shoot down a Russian Cosmosphere. American analysts are convinced that the Russians are using SEER and that they had it first. And so, when the Air Force attack confirmation sensor was designed, it was given a feature intended to defeat Russian infrared detectors. All objects warmer than absolute zero emit infrared radiation. The warmer the object is, the more infrared it emits, and the easier it is for computer-enhanced infrared sensors to detect it. The only way to hide from SEER is therefore to reduce the temperature as low as possible. That's why the Air Force attack confirmation sensor was a cryogenic satellite, a huge cooling system using liquid helium kept the satellite only a few degrees above absolute zero, reducing infrared emissions to nearly nothing. The cryogenic design of the Air Force satellite is what gave the Bolshevik war planners here so much confidence that it would succeed. They were sure that the Russians would be unable to find it in time to destroy it before it was used in war. But, my friends, the Bolsheviks in the Pentagon are wrong about the new Russian target tracking technique. It is not an infrared technique at all. Instead, it's a revolutionary system which detects the atomic vibrations of matter. The Russians call it psychoenergetic range finding, or PRF. When I first reported on Russia's new PRF technique in Audio Letter 42, I reported that the Russians regard it as their master secret weapon. The longer it remains a mystery to the American Bolsheviks, the better it will be for Russia. And so when Space Shuttle 4 launched the Air Force cryogenic sensor last June, the Russians started playing a game. Instead of destroying the satellite right away, they allowed it to be orbited successfully. The Russians knew that the attack confirmation satellite could do them no harm until war itself was about to begin. So they allowed it to stay there untouched for as long as possible. The result was exactly as expected. The long-term survival of the Air Force sensor has convinced the Bolsheviks here that they were right about Russia using SEER. The Pentagon has walked into a major intelligence blunder, and the Russians are encouraging them to keep it up. Throughout the summer, Rockefeller cartel operatives within the CIA fed updates about the Pentagon war plan to the Russians. Those reports continued to say that the war timetable was remaining unchanged, targeted for mid-September. So the Russian Space Command left the Air Force Center alone for the time being. Meanwhile, the Russians began preparing, in a totally unsuspected way, for the moment when they would destroy the satellite. Those preparations had to do with Russia's international telephone service. First, in June, the Soviet Union drastically reduced the number of telephone links to the West. They also made clouded threats to reduce service still further at a later date. In order to keep the intelligence analysts here from guessing what was afoot, the Russians resorted to a little disinformation in the right places. They created falsified leaks that there were unsettled conditions in the Kremlin, a power struggle. The Bolsheviks here, who are always struggling for power, swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. The next major step was the one I mentioned earlier on September 2. That was the day when Russia suddenly cut off all automatic dialing service to and from the West. The Bolsheviks here were startled, but still did not suspect what it really meant. They were too preoccupied with rumblings of trouble in China to worry for long about Russia's telephones. For the final step, the Kremlin waited, hoping that the maneuvers to disrupt the stealth base in Tsingkiang province would succeed. On September 9, they received the mission accomplished signal from the Rockefeller cartel. The Tsingkiang base was temporarily incapacitated thanks to Nixon's recommended bureaucratic entanglement by the Chinese. The next morning, Friday, September 10, there was a sudden total shutdown of most international telephone service to and from Russia. But in order to send a message to America's Bolshevik war planners, a few selected circuits were kept open. Those included Leningrad, Kiev, Minsk, and Tallinn. Their significance lay in the fact that none were targets planned for the initial stealth attack, which I detailed last month. The phone lines were cut off at 7:10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, or 2:10 p.m. Moscow Time. Moments later, the Russian Space Command went to work. A Russian jumbo Cosmosphere was parked in a pseudo-orbit about 2 miles above the Air Force attack confirmation satellite. It had been there for over 2 months from the moment the satellite was launched into orbit from Space Shuttle 4. By using its electromagnetic propulsion system at low power, the Cosmosphere had remained on station instead of slowly drifting away as a normal satellite would. And parked as it was above the downward-looking Air Force satellite, the presence of the Cosmosphere was never detected. Now the time had come. The Cosmosphere aimed its beam weapon and fired. Shortly after 7:10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Friday, September 10, there was bad news for the Bolsheviks here. At the newly operational Air Force Space Command in Colorado Springs, there was a sudden loss of signal from their Indian Ocean satellite. At first, they could not believe that their critical attack confirmation satellite had been attacked. All sorts of things were tried in an effort to reestablish contact with the satellite, all to no avail. The satellite no longer existed. As that Friday morning of September 10 wore on, the Project Z war planners were convened in crisis conference. The question at hand was, what do we do now? For a while, there was an atmosphere of near panic. Some were sure that a first strike by Russia was sure to follow, and that the Pentagon should push the nuclear button without delay. Others argued that if that were the Kremlin's intention, it was already too late. Russia's missiles would be on the way. At the opposite extreme, someone suggested that the whole Project Z war plan be aborted for now and rescheduled later on. Everyone agreed on one thing. Without the attack confirmation sensor, any attack on Russia had become far more risky. After launching the stealth planes from Norway and Turkey, it would just have to be assumed that they had destroyed their targets. With the attack confirmation satellite gone, there would be no way to confirm that. So the all-out follow-up attack by America's nuclear forces might run into a lot more trouble than expected. At that point, someone remarked to the effect, we can still go with a backup plan. Every target in Russia that is attacked by our birds will be obliterated. If international telephone service to Russian target areas is suddenly cut off at 0 hour, we can assume that our birds made it. There's an old military saying that goes, there is always someone who didn't get the word. The planner who suggested falling back on the backup plan based on telephones proved once again how true that saying is. Nearly everyone shouted at him, "The phones to Russia are already shut down." My friend.
Well, it's about time to stop as we come close to the end of the show here. I have been often criticized for simply saying science fiction, but this sounds like another war that was fought in his head. Lots of innuendo, no names, no facts, no documentation other than the fact that he says it happened.
Well, if you follow LaRouche, Skolnick, and May Brussel, you'll have the facts for what was going on at least what was reported in the papers, to show a possibility of what Peter's talking about. But that was the end of part one, the interruption on September 10th. Now we'll continue the show next week or in upcoming weeks and what happened leading up to the 17th.
I think it's interesting to note that saying he said at the end of the tape there, and that is that no matter how good the communication is, whenever the plans are or issued to go to war, someone always doesn't get the word. And that perhaps is indicative of the society as a whole, that there's a lot going on behind the scenes, and society sort of never gets the word.
Well, I have some deep disagreements with what was said. I find that that a lot of it, as I said, is the news facts that lead up to it are documented, and I don't dispute them. What they are chosen to mean, I draw different conclusions from. I think there are questions to be asked as to who orchestrated them, why were they orchestrated, that there was a war and a laser beam fight out in space. It takes it too far away from my comprehension to honestly believe it.
Well, we'll try to go into that next session.
Okay, so join us next week for the continuing saga of the International Connection. For Tom Rich and Bob Marshall, my name is Adam Vaughn, and thanks for listening.